and gentlemen, to Masturbators, the podcast where we talk about sex, love, masturbation, self-love, self-care, feminism, mental health, all the wonderful, important things in life. I'm here with, how do I say your name? Orla.
Orla, yeah.
Quilligan.
Quilligan.
Quilligan. That sounds like your character from Harry Potter, like Orla Quilligan.
It does actually a bit, yeah.
It's very cool.
Thank you.
Recent graduate.
Yes.
Of the... What, English language?
English of the literature.
The literature. Yeah, yeah. Well, that makes sense. You don't really have to. I mean, I guess you can study the English language. I don't know. I'm German. Like, you can study English. I guess you can.
Yeah.
But literature, I suppose, is the study of language as much as...
The anything, use of right? language,
the
in
use
a way.
Of language, yeah.
Putting it to the test, in a way. Yeah.
Amazing. How was that?
I loved it. Yeah. I actually loved it. I think a lot of people are quite sick of their degrees by the end of it, but
okay.
Genuinely, I really, really enjoyed it.
All the way through?
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
cool.
Loved reading, loved getting to chat about it all, so.
Amazing. And now you're here to chat about the world of sex and dating and
that
fun stuff.
That whole shebang.
That whole shebang. And you... So, I don't know where you want to start. Where do you feel like we want to start the conversation about your journey?
Well, yeah, I guess where I am now, sort of romantically, sexually.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of told you before that I'd just recently come out of a relationship, and it was so 2.5 years, which, like, some people might not think that's a very long-term relationship, but for me, obviously, that took up a really kind of formative point in my life, so it definitely feels very long term for me. So that kind of took up the span of my degree at university, which is also kind of important because people see university as a big time for kind of sexual experimentation and exploration. So, you know, being monogamous through that, it's kind of, you know, kind of raises questions, issues for some people.
Should you have been kind
yeah of exactly. But I think one thing that I always realized was that I think I am quite a kind of a big monogamist, probably.
Okay.
I think I like that security. I like being with someone. I think I was talking to someone who their parents also separated when they were very young, but I was about 10 when it happened. But apparently that's quite a common
pattern
to kind of really throw yourself into monogamous relationships if you've come from a family background like that. So I've kind of recognized that in myself. And I don't think I kind of want to fight that. Like, I think that just is how I am happy. But right now I'm definitely not looking for a relationship. So I think I'm trying
taking
to kind
a break
of delve
from monogamy.
I'm enjoying being by myself, genuinely being single and not trying to dive into something else, just genuinely being single. But also, you know, the idea of casual sex is kind of a bit more on the horizon in the way that it wasn't so much before. So that's kind of caused a lot of use of dating apps and stuff like that, which
I always find fascinating because I had Tinder for like an evening. I thought I'd cure my singleness. Then I've liked 8 people by accident because I don't get how Tinder works. You sort of get in, and then like I thought I'd swipe to the menu, but then I'd swiped someone and then they matched and I had to unmatch them because I was like, I don't know you, this is not the plan. And then I just had a nervous breakdown and had to delete that. And noticed that it's not my thing. But I think I recognize what you're talking about and I don't know if that's everyone's pattern, but coming from a home that wasn't particularly happy, I think I'm looking for the exact opposite, which is security, safety, sort of love, everlasting.
Because
I think potentially, and then obviously it depends on the home life, it can be different for different people. But I think just having, like, my parents got divorced when I was young, and my stepdad and my mother have this really weird relationship where I'm like, why are you even... why this makes no sense. So there was never, like, it was never idyllic, and I think that's what I'm looking for now. And I'm very fascinated by people who can sort of jump from relationship to relationship or just have very casual relationships, because it just, in my brain, it doesn't, like, I empathize with it and I find it quite interesting, but in my brain that just doesn't compute for myself. I know.
Yeah. I kind of can't help criticizing people that do that, that kind of, especially girls I'm friends with,
right,
who jump from relationship to relationship, and, you know, if that is how they're happy, they yeah. should 100% do that. But I can't help, I feel really bad, but I do criticize them to myself and think, you know, are you ever truly happy if you yeah. can't be by yourself?
Yeah.
But I think as a sort of slight introvert, you know, that's because I'm really happy by myself.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't really try and apply that to other people. But I do kind of wonder, what is it that you're looking for in someone else so much?
Yeah. I do find it, like, I don't know if I judge it as much, but I guess it is because I would say I analyze it. But then once you've analyzed something, you usually make a judgment whether you like it or not. And it's that thing where I'm like, if you continuously with other people, how are you able to share yourself if you only know yourself in relation to other people? And definitely. You know, that's not a judgment of their character. It's just a personal wondering. But I think for me, it's the other extreme. Like, I'm trying to figure myself out to the extent where I don't feel like I'm ready for a relationship until I'm fully one with myself, which I think is the other extreme and probably isn't ideal either, because then you never learn about yourself in relation to others, which is sort of, I think it has to be a healthy, like with everything, I think it has to be a healthy balance. And maybe also, they're sort of just doing the opposite of what you're doing in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like if I consider that to myself, that I'm not dating at all because I'm just like, no, I need to fix myself. And they are just dating because of, and maybe it's not even such an active thought, but because of that's what fills a specific void or fulfills a specific need. And I find it interesting. I do always find myself judging in a sense of going, oh, I wish you would just stay alone and figure yourself out, which isn't my right, because if they that's not what they need or want. But it does come through, I think, a certain kind of judgment of going, I don't know if you know yourself.
Yeah, yeah. But then you can learn so much about yourself, you know, in a relationship and in relation to someone else. But yeah, it's just that the headspace that it takes up, you know, is a reason why people argue in relationships, because ultimately it's two people with, you can never be the same person. You're going to have totally different upbringings and priorities and kind of ways of thinking. There's always going to be a clash there, whether you're, you know, totally in love or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, not being in a relationship, it frees up so much of your kind of mental space to think about other things, you know, that there are maybe more important things in life, but, or are there, you know, we're all kind of on the same track to, you know, find a mate, kind of, I guess.
Yeah, I do find it interesting. There are people who sort of don't feel like that's an important thing to have that one stable relationship, and they're sort of happy with, because their goals in life are different.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is interesting because I talked to a friend about this, and there's this idea that, like, have you seen Jigsaw by Daniel Sloss on Netflix?
No.
I always bang on about it because I think it's really, really great. And he talks about relationships and how, you know, it's okay to be alone and selfish for a while, and you have to learn to love yourself because before you can have anyone else love you. And my friend said, well, yeah, that potentially is true. However, it's almost like there has to be a healthy middle between maybe not serial dating because you want to forget part of yourself in another person, but then also not serial singleness because you feel like you don't have anything to offer, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And sort of try and find a healthy middle where you focus on yourself and understand that you're a work in progress, like I think every human is until they die, but that you don't shut yourself off from possibilities, I think.
Yeah.
Because that's what I find very difficult. Mm. Like, and that's what I sort of am jealous of, in quotation marks? No, I guess just jealous of these people who do jump into relationship after relationship after relationship, clearly have a skill I don't have.
Yeah.
In connecting with other people, and whether that is connection that is real or not so much, it's something I'm not able to recreate for myself.
Yeah.
And so I think that's also where some judgment sometimes comes from you have a thing I can't have.
Yeah.
And I'd like to, maybe in a different form, but I think, you know, we can learn from each other, and I think in the end of the day, healthy middle, as much as well as doing what you feel is right for you.
Mm.
And I think not being motivated by fear, if that makes sense.
Mm. Mm.
Is, but like, again, that's sort of something you learn as you go along, I think.
Yeah.
It's
definitely an impressive ability to just kind of throw yourself in there and yeah. not have hang-ups and kind of feelings of whatever from the past
yeah.
relationship. Like, that is definitely impressive, because that's something that I feel like I'm struggling with, is that yeah. people say, you know, oh, it takes a set amount of time to get over a relationship.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And I think because it was my decision to end my relationship, I kind of felt very quickly like I had got over it.
Mm-hmm.
But now I realise that I'm actually not. Yeah. I kind of am superficially in quite a lot of ways, but there's still some of that anger creeps up. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, if I bump into him, I'll feel a bit of kind of panic or whatever. Yeah. So I do think it actually does take quite a long time for you to be fully healed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But then maybe I'm the sort of person that also kind of holds on to emotions quite a lot. Not necessarily grudges, but yeah. I think I retain kind of feeling for quite a long time.
Rather than processing it?
Or? Yeah, well, I definitely try to actively process things. I try to be very aware of, you know, what I'm thinking and yeah. feeling about different situations. But I think I do have a tendency to kind of hold on to anger or sadness, or right. you know, not let it override me yeah. or anything, but definitely kind of acknowledge it, because I want to kind of, what's the word, kind of respect it in a way, and mm-hmm. kind of give it that validity
and that space
to, yeah. yeah, but really you can kind of acknowledge that that was a correct way to feel and move past it. Definitely.
Yeah, I get what you mean, because it's that thing, especially when you getting over someone and that's your decision.
Mm.
I think it's very hard to go, oh, but that has negative impact on me. Mm. Yeah. And you sort of just yeah. go, well, and you make that rational choice of, now, no, it's, and even if there is an emotional aspect of, you know, I don't feel that way about that person anymore, they've been a part of your life for a long time.
Yeah.
And whether it's relationships of romantic or platonic mm. or even like work relationships, if you're really happy to leave a job
mm.
and you're just sort of like, ah, I'm out of there. But then, you know, you might still miss the people mm. and your everyday life. And I think it's huge, like for me at least, a huge, like a very seductive thing to just go, nah, I'm done. Take that thing, put it in a box and hide it away.
Mm.
And then 3 weeks later go, oh, why am I so annoyed for no reason?
yeah.
And they go, actually, maybe I have to go back, look through the crap and then process that mm. and then move on, because it subconsciously is somewhere around. But I think it is a very seductive thing to make a choice for yourself and then decide that that's the choice mm. that you've made. But I guess for you it's a bit different if you do feel
mm.
the feelings, you just sort of mm. hold on to them, you said.
Right. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's why I'd love a therapist, really, just get to
that's why I have a chat therapist. It all out.
Literally, that's just the dream. I don't know if that comes from a kind of narcissistic bend though, that I want to be able to just talk about myself every week.
I do sometimes sit in therapy and go, oh, I'm quite enjoying this. It's quite nice that this is about me right now. But then on the other hand, it's sort of, I think you have a right to want to make something about you when mm. you're trying to figure yourself out. Because mm. how can you not? Mm. And like, as much as it's like, because I sometimes wonder, do I have narcissistic tendencies? And I kind of really feel like as someone who wants to make entertainment, you kind of have to, because it's very hard yeah. to go, look at me, I'm making this thing, without being a bit like, it's fucking great that yeah. you're looking at me right now. But then I think it asks, if like the way I see my therapy, it asks enough of you to not be that fun
mm-hmm.
that you sort of retain it or keep doing it mm. for that purpose. Mm. But it is hilarious when sometimes you sit on that couch and go, oh, it's quite nice. It's probably what it feels like when you do a press junket. I'm enjoying myself.
That's exactly how I think I see it in my mind. It's like kind of being like the host of your own talk show. Yeah.
Which I clearly have no interest in. but it's, I think, yeah, if you can access therapy, I feel like everyone should, which is sort of an easy thing to throw out there. Like, I was very lucky of getting my therapy through work, and they had a private health insurance thing, and then I just kept the private health insurance, and in theory I should have another year in there, unless they at some point decide that they're not paying for it anymore, which is something that could happen and something that's scary in its own way, because then you sort of left, because even a relationship with a therapist, it's a very special kind of relationship, and a very much like they're sort of almost safeguarding your thoughts and feelings for you. And like I saw an image today on Facebook, sort of, I don't know if it's a meme or whatever, but of someone sitting on the couch in therapy and having these like this huge mess of wool, just woolen strands in their head, and then like the going the bubble extending to the therapist, and over the therapist's head it was like, it looked like so much shit, and over the therapist's head it was just three what do you call, like a ball of wool, and they were all sort of starting to make sense, and becoming bigger, because they sort of got the strands out of the other person and made sense of it. And that is even something that came up in last therapy session, that I was talking about having files, and it's like I filed one file away, but then there's 150 other files and all of these papers scattered, and I don't know where the fucking start. And my therapist went, well, but maybe what it is that it isn't 150 files, but maybe it's just three four files, and all the papers are scattered around, and I can help you make sense of finding the right file, and so it'll feel less. And it sort of feels like the same image. I think that's why it stuck with me, because I was like, that's literally the thing I discussed in therapy. So yeah, that, even though maybe dating isn't a thing, sort of giving into that relationship was really hard. And like, you get a weird attachment to therapists where it's very interesting. I don't know if you've ever had.
No, but I've friends that have therapists, and they kind of discuss this idea of, you know, what's the boundary, and I kind of think, how can you not slightly kind of be really attracted to this person? Kind of making sense magically of your life, and obviously making you feel better a lot of the time.
I think there is a part of that, even if it's not a romantic attraction, like even if it's like a maternal attraction or something. I think there is something, and like, and I did at the beginning of therapy, even though I went there because I wanted to, there were times, and I do this in my private life as well, when I feel too emotionally exposed, I get very abrasive and harsh and like unfair. And I did that a couple of times with my therapist, and then I was like, no, I'm not doing that, until like you get over it and you realize, I was doing that because it's quite scary to open up to people, especially if they are meant to help you. And it's very interesting how that dynamic works. But obviously, if they're good therapists, they're not going to do things that would compromise that sort of almost. It's, I don't know, it's a clinical relationship as much as it is a safeguarding one, I think.
Yeah.
And that is important in a way that stays that way.
Do you find yourself kind of wondering what they are thinking about you? I think that's what I would kind of worry. I think, do they think I'm in the wrong? Do they think I'm crazy?
It is. I always wonder also how much your therapist is allowed to tell you that you're a dick. Because just as a general, because I had a friend when I was in high school who was a terrible person. Like, she just straight up was an asshole.
Yeah.
And very, and she had bipolar disorder, and I'm not saying it was because of that, but she used that to go, yeah, but you know, that's how, why I am that way. And I'm like, you're being untrustworthy because you have bipolar disorder? That doesn't make any sense. Like, you can't just take your mental health situation and make that the reason why you're behaving like a terrible person. Yeah. And her therapist, like, she would tell me stories where I would, in my head, judge them as something very specific, and she would tell, and my therapist also said it wasn't my fault, and I was like, I don't know if that wasn't your fault, because you, like, whatever the story was, you if it was an argument, I don't actually even remember. I just remember having that emotional idea in my head of, like, it sounds like your therapist isn't being impartial. It sounds like your therapist is trying to allow you to be in the role you've cast yourself in. And that's something I wonder sometimes, if you cast yourself, because you do cast yourself in relationships with other people, I think, as the villain or the victim.
Yeah.
And and then people sort of run with it. And I always wonder, I mean, my therapist does sometimes put into perspective what I'm telling myself about myself, which is why I think they are potentially more impartial and honest about what they think of you. But then my first therapist, and I'm really sorry to say this, which was through the NHS and not private. I think she was a young doctor. She was, because I didn't want to wait so long, and she was very overworked, and she had night shifts in between, and sometimes our sessions had to be cancelled. And sometimes she just sat there looking at me, and was a very specific kind of, they called it dynamic psychotherapy, which basically meant I was talking for 45 minutes and there was nothing from her side, and that just didn't do anything.
Absolutely nothing.
No, and I actually said at some point, I don't think this is doing anything. I'm just like, I could be doing this on my own.
Well, that's the thing. Although I understand it as a concept, because it's basically forcing you to spew out whatever is on your mind, and it kind of pinpoints what it is that's bothering you.
Yeah.
You could just do that at a wall.
Exactly. Literally what I said. I was like, I could talk to a wall. I don't, like, this is not doing anything. And the thing was, she was sitting there going, I'm going to mime this for all you listeners out there. And you just thought, she's probably thinking about, and she, for everyone who didn't see my incredible acting right now, I just sighed and moved my shoulders in a bored fashion. And you just sort of sit there and wonder, what are they thinking? Either I'm boring them to death, which is also kind of horrible, because that would mean that your problems aren't even interesting enough to stay focused on you. Mm. Or they're really busy and they're thinking about lunch, which, again, they shouldn't be doing right now. And I actually brought it up, and she was like, well... And I was like, well, you know, when you do that, it really feels like you don't care. And she was like, how would that make me feel? And I was like, that's not the question. You can't just ask that question as an answer to things I say always. That's not, how would that make me feel? Like, my problems aren't valuable. And then that was that. And she was like, and I was like, cool. So you've just taught me the thing I already knew.
Yeah.
But you haven't acknowledged what I just said to you. And so that, I don't know if that was a year of therapy. And I don't know. I feel like it has opened up something. And in a way, it's then helped me to go on to have this therapy that's very, very helpful, and where the engagement is very different. But now it's less, it is a lot of me talking, but it's, I feel like I have a clearer idea, maybe not what they think of me, but how they process what I say.
Yeah.
And I find it very very difficult in life, as much as in therapy, I suppose, to find people who process the things I say. And, like, this is going to sound like I'm a total dick, but at the speed I say them, and with a different perspective. Because I tend to overthink everything to an extent where I feel like I've got all the perspectives.
Yeah.
And what my current therapist is doing, she's offering up a perspective that I haven't had, which then makes me feel seen and understood in a way that I think allows me to feel like there can't really be negative judgment, because there is just judgment of the things I say, rather than them just sitting there for an hour and they could be thinking anything. I have an insight into what they're thinking, and their insight is actually helping me move on from something or see something differently, and then, like, as I said, metaphorically sort of file it in that cabinet. You do sometimes wonder what they think when the session is over, because it's this is very thing. Like, both of my therapists do this, where we have to ride up in an elevator to get to the space, and it's like, you don't talk, and it's sort of like, don't talk until they sit down and you sit down, and then you go, hi. And, like, I once had that thing where I came in and I was like, how are you doing? And we both laughed. She was like, maybe we'll start with you, because like, they never answer that kind of question. Like, it's not about that kind of relationship. And my therapist has this thing, when I leave the room, she stands up and waits until I've left. And I, like, have the urge of asking her what that's meant to do.
Yeah.
But I never do. But it always feels really weird, because, like, you get up and you put on your coat and she just stands there looking at you. And you're like, I guess because it's a very clear cut of the conversation that was just had.
Yeah.
Because she's not sitting in the same position and you sort of know it's over. And there's no, like, there's a big thing about not running the session over and stuff and hijacking those moments when you put on your jacket for therapy. But yeah, it is very interesting, like, the therapist, patient, like, therapeutic relationship. It's very interesting and very, very it's very much like dating, because you kind of go there and get to know a person and you have to get along. Like, I feel like having a bad therapist is like being in a terrible relationship.
Yeah. If you just detest the person that's meant, you're meant to be kind of entrusting so much to, I can't imagine how awkward and awful that experience would be.
Yeah, and you don't even have to detest them, you just have to go and watch them think about spaghetti or something and go, I resent, well, it's a resentment, I guess. It's not like hatred, but it is, I think it's like when your partner doesn't clean up after themselves or something, it's the silent resentment that just builds of like, I don't even know if you know that this relationship isn't working for me. Like, you know, that literal thing of going, and then it's hard to break up, because if you're through the NHS, then you'll have to wait, you'll be on another waiting list. So you kind of, and it is sort of like a problematic relationship, because you try to make it work, because that's sort of the best thing you have right now. So in that way, it's a bit like dating.
It's kind of strange, because they have to be, not likeable, that is not their job, but they have to make you feel at ease and comfortable enough to talk about things, but they also have to very clearly, well, they have to make it very clear that this isn't a normal social interaction. Like, your therapist kind of standing up and kind of that slightly odd behavior of, you know, not saying hi until you're in the room.
Yeah,
they have to do that to make it very clear that this isn't just two friends hanging out.
And yeah,
it's really strange that they have to do that. But you're, so the one that you would just be in silence and think about spaghetti, would she take notes?
No.
So it was literally just,
yeah, and none of my therapists has ever taken notes while I was in the room. Okay. I think maybe the first assessment they did. But like, I think a lot of cliches are just not real, or maybe some, I think therapists probably work in different ways, especially private therapists. I sometimes imagine have different kind of leeway of what they do and how they conduct themselves. But yeah, she just sat there, and I'm guessing she wrote a report afterwards, so maybe she was trying to retain information.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, but this, that I just recall one of the most irritating things being me recounting really traumatic things, and her just sitting there going, like, not even audibly, but just this this movement of the shoulders, or the, like, the rearranging of how you sit when you, like, you know, you've been in a conversation for too long, and sometimes it's discomfort, but it's just, it's that thing of how I register her discomfort. And that I register her discomfort. And that's very different with my therapist now. Because I don't register, even if there is, maybe there is, I don't know. But I don't register her discomfort. I just, she sort of has a very clear position. And like, even if she shifts, it doesn't seem like it's something. Because she talks through the therapy session. I think that's what makes it different. Because the other person just sat there, and like, the only sort of milestones I remember from the first therapy with the NHS is when she actually did say something, and I would literally like try to train and go like, this was really helpful for me, like, if we could more do more of this, and the next session would be the same non-talkative thing, and you just go, you just feel not heard, which is really weird when you're in therapy, and that's sort of what you're meant, I guess, to feel like. But but it's very interesting and very fascinating, and I think everyone should have a therapist.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's kind of, I think everyone should have a therapist, because I think as well, I don't know, it's so weird. Is it a thing of the times that, you know, we're having such kind of a sensory overload nowadays, and, you know, everything is so wrong in the world that we're not, people say we're not supposed to be able to cope with kind of suffering on this level. So is it a modern thing that everyone needs a therapist, or is it that everyone throughout time should have had therapists, and that, you know, prevents a lot of kind of letting trauma slip through and abusive kind of behavior slip through different generations? You know, if people had a therapist helping them sort things out and kind of, you know, nipping those behaviors in the bud, sort of thing, should everyone ever have had a therapist? And then the fact that therapists have therapists is just,
that's so really fascinating, isn't it? But I actually had therapy three times, and once was 12 sessions before I ever had any long-term therapy. And I remember she wasn't particularly helpful either, but she was a bit more helpful because it was a bit more of a conversation. And I remember leaving on the last session and being like, I don't think this was enough. And they were like, well, at the moment we can't offer you more because that's what you get right now. And I feel like I left and she was... I felt like she had tears in her eyes. I wasn't certain, but I felt like I had made her cry because, like, the last thing I said to her, like, the whole hour was about how I'm not sure I can cope on my own and I wasn't doing really well and I was sort of left to my own devices with my eating disorder at the time, which was its own shitty problem. And I the last thing I said was, no, I'll be fine. And I feel like that sort of got her.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I don't know if that was hay fever or something else, but it just really felt like there was a real desire on her part to help me and sort of incapability, not due to who she is or what she does as a therapist, but sort of the tools that she's given. And I think that must be really hard when you aren't a private therapist. And I don't know how any therapists feel, whether they're private or not. I think a helplessness is probably sometimes just there because you're meant to not fix someone, but help them. And I imagine it's very hard if that doesn't work. But yeah, I don't remember what the beginning of your question was, but
everyone needing a therapist.
Yeah, everyone needing a therapist and therapists needing therapists. Yeah. I think therapists need therapists because of the fact that they're dealing
with so much
traumas thrown at them. And I think people probably needed therapists all along. Like, if you think about generations that were in the war, and how therapist just wasn't a thing, and you just kind of moved on and went on. And like you said, I think trauma was definitely passed on through generations. I still feel like my mother had that trauma passed on because her mother was a child in the war and she experienced war, and she, I think, never got help for that. And so I feel like the way you raise your children is how you pass on that trauma. And I think if at the time, I don't even know if it was a concept that was easily available. Like, when did Freud happen? That kind of been that long ago.
Early 1900s, yeah.
I would imagine so. apologize to everyone who's actually learned about this.
Unintelligent.
But, you know, I think psychotherapy probably wasn't that big an idea. Especially in a war-torn country where you have to build up the country. That's sort of probably last priority.
When actually what war does and these big political events actually does to people's personal psychology is actually so significant.
Yeah.
So my grandmother, well, both my grandparents on my dad's side, they were children during the Second World War. And you kind of, from everything we've been taught about it at school, it's kind of, you know, seen in this very kind of stoic light, and you kind of hear of all the success stories and the victory, and, you know, we kind of, like, we were never kind of taught to understand the traumatic personal effect it had. And my grandma, she recently developed very late onset schizophrenia. This was like a year ago. And I was kind of saying to my dad, gosh, is like, am I gonna get schizophrenia? Because that was actually something I'd always been a bit worried about. That in particular, the times when I've been stressed, you know, I've felt like I was kind of feeling that in some way. And he said, well, he's very much of the school of thought that our psychology is kind of based on your environment rather than it being kind of passed down through genetics, which, you know, I don't know what I think really about that. But it's, he said, you know, your grandparents, they went through such a traumatic event. Like, they were evacuees. They were sent off to stay with random families who undoubtedly were not nice to them.
Yeah.
They both ran away from their... the families they were staying with multiple times, which I think is a pretty strong indicator that something was very wrong, but that wasn't talked about at all. And so there's so much of that locked up within them. Of course it's going to kind of explode later in life. And, you know, the environment that I live in today couldn't be further apart. So he was saying, you know, I don't think you should worry about that happening to you because what they went through is just unimaginable in comparison. Yeah. But obviously there are different, you know, ways that we suffer nowadays, but it's true. I think we kind of see these things that happened in the past and we don't idealize them at all, but we don't treat them with the same way. We don't understand them in the same way. We can't imagine that something that happened, you know, 70 years ago and
still affects,
is celebrated,
yeah,
would have the same effect on people, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I come at history from a very different angle because I'm German, so mm-hmm. we see that mm. part of history yeah. very differently for very obvious reasons. I think the human aspect, like, you hear numbers and you yeah. get ideas, but you don't actually realize that those were people fighting yeah, wars.
Definitely.
That war, I think, is such a big idea that you don't mm. realize that they were mostly just kids.
Like, yeah.
they had to go leave their home, leave their families, and do horrible things that definitely weren't their choice.
Yeah.
And then come home to a country that, I mean, in a way, I guess the Second World War, there was the First World War very close before, so I suppose there was an understanding of maybe what that felt like by older generations. Mm. But I think just in general, the idea of war and understanding that, I think it's impossible.
Mm.
And so coming back to a life that is entirely different and having seen the things you've seen, like, PTSD must have been a thing back then, but nobody
definitely.
Knew what it was.
Yeah.
You
know, that they'd even call that, they have the term shell shock,
mm-hmm.
which I always thought was very different, but I guess that kind of was their way of describing PTSD.
Yeah.
And the fact that they just, I love the way that language kind of informs the way we think about things.
Yeah.
So the fact that they called that shell shock, like, that first word shell refers to, like, the actual
yeah.
kind of ammunition used.
Yeah.
So it's, again, tying it to something very physical,
yeah.
saying, hey, this is just reaction to kind of the physical blow they received,
yeah.
you know, rather than it obviously being something entirely mental.
And something psychological. And
yeah.
I guess because the idea of, like, again, I could be going off completely wrong historical facts, but I just don't think that the idea of psychology was that big. And also,
mm.
if you imagine that the state of the country is, and you probably don't have the facility to give that kind of,
mm.
even if it was a thing, I don't know if you could give that on a large scale because you're busy building
mm.
stuff and healing people and
yeah.
physically, because I guess those are the most obvious
yeah.
ones. But yeah, I mean, I think therapy, I mean, there are people who don't like it, I'm imagining.
Mm.
There are people who say, I don't need it. But I think the idea of access to it, I think it's so important that that would be made available.
Mm.
And I imagine when you were in uni, you usually have a counselor and stuff in-house.
Yeah. except that was the kind of main issue, is that it was very hard to
mm-hmm.
get a hold of, gain access to. Yeah, there was a time during my degree where I was really suffering. Like, I felt like my mental health was really affecting me every day. And you kind of had to do, like, a self-evaluation online to qualify
mm-hmm.
for counselling. And it got to the point where I was feeling very physical symptoms
mm-hmm.
As a result of what I thought was anxiety. And I kind of wasn't able to sleep properly, and it was affecting my eating and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't technically qualify for counselling.
You didn't?
Because, obviously, I hadn't raised an alarm of...
Yeah.
That, you know, I might have done something really severe to myself. But, you know, even though I was saying this is affecting my day-to-day life, and...
You weren't sick enough.
Yeah, yeah. So there's that whole controversy over universities not providing enough
mm-hmm.
access to counselling. And I kind of read an article, actually I've read so many articles about this, people kind of spewing their ideas about this. One saying that actually the rate of suicide in universities isn't actually higher than the national average, so there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought, that is an awful way to look at it.
Yeah.
First of all, we shouldn't be seeing
counting
the average as the norm. We should be trying
yeah.
to lower that.
Yeah.
And also, these are, you know, sometimes quite vulnerable young people in your care university, it's not like school, but these are people who are going through incredibly transformative times. They're alone, they're away from families for the first time. You shouldn't also be treating that average as something to strive for. You should I think there's much more of an impetus for them to be trying to take care of their students personally.
And also that sort of means that the national average can't be that good.
Yeah, like, to me, that not just means,
oh, so everyone needs therapy rather than going, yeah they're fine.
Like, no one needs therapy.
Yeah, exactly. We're all good.
Yeah.
Especially if you pay in this country, you pay so much.
Exactly.
So you just sort of go, where does that money go?
Where is the money going? Exactly.
But I guess that's a question with most things. Like, why isn't the NHS funded properly so that we can give care? And that's the sort of thing that's so scary. Like, when people actually do harm themselves and end up in ER, there isn't really that much you can do. Like, sometimes people are held for 24 hours or something, and then they're sent off with a urgent referral for therapy that can then also take forever. And I've, like, had people on the podcast who've talked about how they were really, really in bad places, and the therapy they got just wasn't very consistent. Like, they had a different therapist every week, so basically had the same conversation every week because they had to explain themselves and they could never get into it further, and that kind of stuff. I think on a whole, as a society, even though we now know that psychology is important and that trauma has to be healed, I think it's just still, we're failing not just young people, I think we're failing everyone on such a huge scale. And then if you think about not having private therapy, my therapist costs £140 an hour, which I, in a world, like in a million years, couldn't afford. I can afford it through insurance right now. And so, you know, you kind of, the people who sort of judge doctors for not being in the best part of the NHS. But I think it's like, we talked about teachers briefly before. I think you sort of at some point feel like, I imagine, you were given a framework to work in, and if that isn't supportive enough, I think almost as a self protective measure, you have to remove yourself from a frame that is crumbling. And it's, I think as much as people love the NHS and what it does, if you continuously overworked and continuously close to a mental breakdown yourself, at some point you're going to have to go with your mental health and go, maybe private care is just easier and for everyone.
Of course you wouldn't judge a medical professional for wanting to work in private healthcare at all. Like, I totally understand that. Pays far better, far better hours, you know. But I do think it, because at the moment I think the NHS, it is being it's running still pretty well because of, frankly, the kind of generosity of nurses and doctors who are definitely working longer hours than they need to, taking on other people's jobs, taking on other responsibilities and stresses. If they all started doing kind of the bare minimum that's expected of them, I think it, you know, people would be just dying on the streets tomorrow.
Yeah, and it isn't in any way, I'm not, you know, I love the NHS and its principle, and I think that unfortunately we live in a political climate where the beautiful thing that is the NHS and the idea of the NHS is purposefully broken down and underfunded so that you can point at it and go, see, it doesn't work. Because that is how you get people on your side. You you take away the things they need and then they'll believe your lies and think that maybe, you know, we have to privatize, where you just have to wonder, where's that money going that isn't going into the NHS? And the absolutely kudos to all those nurses and doctors and junior doctors who are working so hard and it must be so difficult.
And it's out of their pride of the NHS, because when they talk about it, they always say, you know, we love that, they have this love for this abstract noun of the NHS, and it's amazing how that admiration of it pushes them to overwork themselves so much, which, you know, they obviously do not have to, but it's amazing that they do want to.
I love how we got here from sex and relationships.
It's our love for the NHS, I guess.
And it's also, I think, and that again, it's a relationship, and it's I think it ties back into mental health. I think people and relationships with themselves and with others, like, you know, to overextend yourself so much in the course of the NHS. But we can leave that behind now and go back to I'm trying to tie this in, and I'm like, no, actually it's just interesting to talk about. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with anything. But so you were in a monogamous relationship and you were very happy in that.
Yeah.
And then you're now moving on to... So what dating apps are you using right now?
I am across... I'm pretty across it. So
Bumble?
I'm
Bumble,
Tinder, and Hinge.
Is that the one where you kind of have to do an action... Like, you have to be more social or something before you can get in touch or
I think
like that.
That's like... a jigsaw one or something.
Oh, okay.
I think I know the one you're talking about. I don't know what it's called, but the kind of logo is like a jigsaw puzzle or something. But this one, there are questions on your profile that you've answered.
Right.
Like, they're just kind of like creative prompts.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone has to kind of have said something about themselves. Whereas obviously on Tinder and Bumble, it can be very, very superficial. It's kind of more aimed towards like casual hookups, I think, because it can just be based on pictures.
Yeah.
Whereas I think Hinge, you literally have to answer questions to have a complete profile. So it kind of forces people to open up a bit more. And I do kind of feel like I've had a lot better conversations on that app because of it. Because... you know, on my Tinder and Bumble profiles, I haven't really said anything, so I just feel like it's a bit awkward to say something when you don't need to.
It's very weird.
But then I do feel like the kind of... I think Tinder is pretty bad for kind of genuine connections.
Mm-hmm.
Bumble, I think it's interesting because obviously its whole kind of USP is that the women make the first move.
Yeah.
So you have to be the first one to send messages. Which, first of all, I find very stressful trying to keep on top of it.
And I love, I used Bumble Business for a while, and then I just realised I've not touched it again, because I also don't understand how Bumble works.
Yeah.
I'm very bad with all those apps. But it, like, gives you these prompts of, this is a great first sentence. I'm like, this is not how people talk to each other. Like, how is your... How did you get into your line of work? Or something just really random, where you're like,
exactly. Yeah, and that's actually really weird how it interferes with you like that, because sending a message to someone and I was just going to say hey, because I wasn't particularly interested in them, I just thought, why not? And it popped up with a little bubble saying, oh, you're less likely to get a response with something like this.
Oh, so right, yeah.
It kind of detected what I was saying, automatically was kind of giving me a different...
strategy
thing to say. Isn't that really bizarre? Like, this kind of...
It's like AI helping you to find connection.
It's already a kind of slightly dystopian future where we're getting artificial intelligence interfering
and
with our
relationships.
And it is
like, you know, that joke, that trope in comedies where a guy goes on a date and has this, like, earpiece.
Yeah.
And people telling him what to say
like that.
So that he's... It's usually the one that's shy and doesn't get ladies, and then suddenly they help him to chat up a chick. And then... you've got this Bumble thing telling you, actually, if you talk to her like that, or if you talk to her like this, you might have more success.
Yeah.
So there is a noticeable difference between the connections made on Tinder to the connections made on Bumble and Hinge, or more Tinder and Bumble versus Hinge? Or
yeah.
Or is it different on all of them?
Well, this is the other thing, because it's women talk first on Bumble, my friend has a theory that it attracts a certain type of... man who's maybe a bit more insecure, wants the validation from women, which I'm not sure how true that is, but it's an interesting theory, because I don't think I've massively clicked with many people on Bumble and kind of had a weird string of dates with this one guy, and I felt like maybe he was quite insecure and had kind of confidence issues. But yeah, so they definitely attract different people and kind of form different relationships as apps, which I think is really interesting.
So you've found Tinder to be the one that's kind of least effective to build actual relationships.
Yeah, but then again, this is the other thing, is that I'm not actually... I think
looking
I fall so easily into the trap of, oh, well, you know, I get on better with this person, this is better for a relationship, but I'm not actually looking for a relationship. So I think it's quite hard to unlearn that drive of looking for someone like that, when actually, if what I want more at the moment is, frankly, kind of just like physical and sexual fulfillment, I should be kind of looking in a different route.
But should you? Because
yeah,
that's the other question, isn't it? What would is the guy you can't really talk to but is physically very attractive? Is that gonna be good sex? I don't know.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't know either.
but it's in theory. I can imagine that it's quite hard to unlearn what you're actually looking for. But then I wonder if sort of purposefully going against it is going to serve you in any way.
Yeah. Also because I am just so intimidated by anyone really attractive and that I can't talk to. Yeah, I just find that so intimidating. So I don't see how that would work, to be honest. Even getting to a sexual level with someone like that.
That you can't talk to.
You know, I'd be like, surely you don't want to talk to me. No.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that would be an interesting social experiment. Yeah. How hot can the people be you swipe?
Exactly. But I think that's what's so interesting about dating apps is that you are kind of filtering. It is very cleverly helping you filter out who is out of your league, who you don't find attractive enough.
Yeah.
You know, it is kind of through this having to swipe right on each other and matching, it is kind of showing you who I guess is kind of within your realm reach. Or something. Yeah, it's bizarre.
It's really odd. I was on the train the other day and I looked I watched someone swipe through Tinder.
Yeah.
It's like he swiped like 20 women in those 5 minutes or it might be an exaggeration, maybe 5 to 10. But I just went, I kind of don't want to be at the other end of that swiping. Yeah. Like it's a very, because you sort of see it from your angle where you're the one that does the swiping, but the other people are doing the exact same.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not special enough. Which is like my own personal hang up of like needing that one true love and whatever the fuck. But it just doesn't seem like, to me, it just feels like if you've swiped 20 people and then we've accidentally swiped each other, I don't know if that's like Romeo and Juliet enough.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but I also think, because I think, oh gosh, everyone's probably meeting through dating apps now. And yeah, I'm not sure that's such a bad thing. I think it's, you know, it makes things quite simple. And people do meet really amazing people there that they have a lot of things in common with. And they kind of, you know, have that natural kind of affinity with. But I don't even know if I don't even know how I would go about kind of engaging with a complete stranger in real life, you know?
I
think if you're not particularly extroverted, it's pretty hard. I don't know how I would do that even.
It's
kind of embarrassing.
And also, like, because the thing is, I always think that these apps are so artificial, but then how did people used to go out? They used to go out to a pub or to whatever and then chat to each other that way. And what do you have? You usually have a physical cue that this might work for you. And I don't know, because I'm always, again, like this romanticized idea of I will meet someone in the real world, and how am I going to meet someone if I, like, I've literally noticed about myself in the last week, I started this new job, and like every now and then I go in and out of the office and I meet people in the corridor, and I'm like, usually I very quickly look at them, make eye contact, smile, but then I look away instantly. Yeah. And I always wonder, like, if it just started to get me wondering how rude they think I am. Because I make eye contact for, like, a second. So it was like, I acknowledge you're here, I try to smile, but then I look away. And I can sort of see out of the corner of my eye that they're still smiling. And I
feel
wonder
so guilty
if they,
about that, too.
Yeah, like, did they feel, would they, if I held the eye contact, would we have a conversation? Would they feel just as uncomfortable as I am? Are they less uncomfortable? That my personal incapability of human connection, like, sometimes it's even, I don't mind, I give money to homeless people, but I'm more likely to do it if they don't ask me for it.
Really?
Because that... Like, on a train or something, if they go through and they ask, that's fine. But, like, if they have a thing where they look up at you and they make a human connection, I'm very likely to sort of walk away because it's too much.
Yeah, it kind of causes you to kind of retract rather than... Exactly. Yeah.
And it's that thing where you're like, so how am I supposed to get that love of my life in the non, in quotation marks, artificial way if I'm not fucking able to hold eye contact for 2 seconds? So in a way... It's probably and very definitely it answered a need that people have. And the question is sort of, is the, where's that music coming from? Is that from outside?
Yeah, I think it's
okay. I was like, I just listened to the music and I went, Why am I hearing music now? Sorry, there's someone with very loud music outside of my window and just got me.
Sounds fun.
It sounds fun, yeah. But yeah, the need was answered for less human connection in dating, which is kind of weird. Mm. But I think as a society, we now have that need. Like we talked about it before we started recording, that it's nice to hear podcasts and music and have them in your ear, because you kind of, it gets easier to be in public spaces with people, especially on trains where you're like, no one wants to make eye contact. And so it's funny how I'm sort of against the concept, because I'm weirdly sort of idealistic about how I want to meet someone, but I'm also incapable of actually, even if it's non-romantic, just make a human connection in an elevator or something.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something I want to kind of challenge myself to do more, because I know for certain that I have really limited friendships or possibilities of friendships with people through just not being particularly friendly, because I just feel a bit awkward. Like so many times I'll see someone that I kind of vaguely know on the street and I just pretend to have not seen them. I'm actually queen of pretending I haven't seen people. Same. I can magic up a distraction out of nowhere. Excellent. But I think that's just so rude. Why do I have this impulse to do that? And, you know, if I was a really extroverted person who said, oh, hi, and then started a little chit-chat, you know, you don't know where that's going to end up. And I really admire people who can do that. And I totally see the benefit of doing it. But I just don't do it myself. So I'm definitely trying to challenge myself to do that more,
I think. It is a skill that you can learn. Like, I think the thing is, I think I'm good at it but I just choose not to. Like, I'm very good at small talk and I can connect to people if I have to. If I'm going to a party and I'm in the right mood, I'll be talking with everyone. But I just don't see the point. Like, that's the thing. I don't see the point of connecting with random people. Even though whenever you do it, it's kind of fun. Like, I've never had a conversation and gone, oh, I wish I hadn't. Like, unless they're so really rude or something.
Yeah.
It's never, like, you never go into a human interaction and go, oh, that was for nothing. Because, like, usually you get something out of having opened up that avenue. But, like you said, when I see someone I know, I'm like, how can I, I'm just going to, oh, what time is it? And then just do that for 2 minutes while they hopefully walk past. Or, you know, my phone just got really interesting. Or I'm just looking the other way. And number one, I can't believe that they never see that I've seen them.
Well, I think this is a thing that we fall into. A lot of times they will have also seen you and also perhaps chosen to ignore you too. And you think, oh, I'm so clever, I managed to avoid them. But they've probably seen you too.
And then you wonder if they are as nuts as you are and they would have done the same thing. Or if they would be like, open to conversation, or if they'd only be open to conversation because if you cue that you have seen them, you kind of have to do that.
Yeah.
So are they grateful? Are they confused? By the way, if you hear rumbling, my tummy is like literally rumbling, so I apologize for that.
It's just something that just gurgles.
But yeah, it's that weird thing where I'm like, fuck relationships. I first have to be able to talk to
people
in the office without going, ah!
Yeah.
Like, don't make me connect. Like, what I also hate is when people, when I'm like going down the corridor to the office and then someone is before me, like 10 meters before me, and then opens the door. Oh, and I'm like, gosh. Oh, fuck, why is the door still open? And then you suddenly have to sort of jog to the door, even though you could have just had a leisurely walk. And then you have to make eye contact and go, ah, thank you. Even though you resent them for making you walk fast. And it's, again, it's that thing of like, why do they think... Like, because for me, it's like, someone is 1.5 meters away. That's far enough for me to just let the door shut. Like, I'm like, unless you're literally right next to me, I'm like, oh, I've not seen you, or I have no time to leave the door open. It's just that inherent, again, my stomach, I apologize. That in some people's capability of just being like, I see you, I'm opening that door for you. I'm like, why do you make me?
Well, I guess they
do that.
It's probably a massive fear of something being really awkward that you're going to suddenly hate them for not leaving the door open.
Maybe.
For you or whatever.
I guess people have their own personal hang-ups about why they do the things they do.
I think we go around thinking that everyone else is totally confident and fine and we're the ones being weird, but I think definitely everyone is kind of has some sort of fear that something's going to go wrong socially. But how did you feel this is a very, very cliche question, but how did you feel as a German person? Do you feel like there's a kind of difference in the way that kind of English people socially interact? Because isn't there that whole thing that in German that isn't really an explicit word for awkward?
There, I mean, yeah, awkward is a very specific word because it means sort of embarrassing as much as it means uncomfortable. Mm. I think we have a lot of, which is sort of why I love the English language a lot more than the German language, because we, I think the equivalent of an awkward silence would be, we have a word for uncomfortable, so that would be the word I use, or we have a word for embarrassing, so that would be, but awkward, sort of much like anxiety, are words that I don't think have a real equivalent. Like, it's very interesting for me, the language and how English lends itself to how I can express, for example, that I have social anxiety. In Germany, I think anxiety is, which I guess is what anxiety is, but it's fear disorder. That's sort of the only word you have for it. So explaining to people that you have a fear disorder is very different from going, oh, I'm just anxious, and everyone understanding that that's sort of the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's that word that people can connect to. And in Germany, it's almost like you take it more towards it being a mental disorder by saying it's a fear disorder, even though obviously anxiety is a mental condition and I have it, and I, like, I'm not judgmental towards other people. I'm like, you have anxiety too, let's be afraid together, but like, don't look at me. But yeah, language lends itself a lot more to expressing how I feel in English. I don't know if that was the question. But yeah, there is no word for awkward.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
There's no word for awkward in Germany. Like, it's just five different words that all mean different things in different situations.
Yeah.
There's no universal language. I don't know about how German people behave.
Yeah, do you think that's but do you think that language has resulted because of a difference in the behaviours? Like, do you think, because I studied German at school and so I got to go to Germany a few times and I loved it.
Okay.
But it is definitely true that, but I feel like it's maybe in general in Europe, people are just a bit more straightforward, a bit more open, a bit more direct, and there's kind of less kind of faffing about.
Yes. And we are definitely fussing more honest, over things.
Yeah.
Like, that English, like, English people are so polite. Sometimes I'm like, do you want to give me the last piece of cake, or you're just scared of going, I want that last piece of cake? And I think in Germany, we're like, we all want that last piece of cake. Like, I think, like, very cliche, because we are very direct. And I've had several friends who are German or of a German-speaking background, who've gotten the, especially when they're sort of in leading positions in England, who've gotten the feedback, you can't be this direct with English people. You can't tell someone what they've done wrong. You need to package it differently. And I'm like, I don't fucking understand what you're saying. If you, like, if you don't tell me what you want or what I've done wrong, I'm just going to presume everything is fine and you don't want anything. And I think that's why, I think there is a bit of a cultural disconnect. Like, a very, I don't know if we are more, if we talk to each other more, like, as a people. I think that might depend on where you are. If you're in a big city or in a small city, I imagine that, like, if you're in Berlin, the feeling might be a lot closer to what it's like in London than if you are in the city I grew up in, which is 60,000 people. I wonder if there's a big cultural divide between, I think there's a divide in, like, how nice we want to seem. I don't think people in Germany care so much about what other people think of them. That's a general idea I have. On the other hand, I grew up not thinking, like, you know, I grew up in my specific bubble, but I do think we're more direct, and I think we give less of a shit about what other people think of us. But then saying that, I've got German friends who very much care about that and never ask for what they want in a restaurant or something, which then to me seems very English. They're Germans, so it can't really be, you know, I think, but I think there is a cultural divide. I don't know how I would feel, because now I'm in my body and in my brain, and if I go back to Germany, I carry that with me. So I don't know if people sort of would force you more to connect with them or that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think more direct is the only thing that I feel like is an actual truth.
Yeah.
And the other things I think are shadings of culture and...
Yeah.
I think that always changes. But I do think language very much... We talked last week, we talked about gender. And I think language very much colours how we see ourselves and how we see each other. And like, for example, there being very gendered language in Germany, I think is... kind of very important towards how we express ourselves, like the word if someone isn't gender queer and we use the pronouns them and they, I don't think that, I don't even know, I think we made up a word in German but it wasn't readily available, which is why it feels more alien, kind of like not having a word for anxiety. I think that's why I prefer the English language, because I feel like it makes things more straightforward, which is why I feel like maybe the culture is a bit... It's very interesting how English people are more straightforward, even though they have a language that lends itself more to that.
Well, I think it allows for so much more kind of... I don't know, it's weird because there are so many options of things to say.
Yeah.
And because you can create a sentence that says, I think that perhaps I might want you to possibly... Like, and that makes perfect grammatical sense. It allows for people to kind of go into tiny subtleties and kind of go around things that they want to say very easily.
Yeah.
Whereas if you kind of have fewer words to choose from, you have to be a bit more definitive, maybe.
I think there's just more direct language. Like, I think German is not... You can't make it as kind in quotation marks. Like, you can be very sweet about it, but there just aren't this... May I perhaps do that? It's like, can I have that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe, can I possibly have that? But, like, we wouldn't take these... those routes that the English language can make you... May I possibly, like, if you don't mind, kind of...
Yeah.
That's not a sentence I think I would ever... Yeah. Which is probably why you see more direct as a German person using the English language, because you just tend to take the translation of what you want to say in your brain and just like, can I do that? And British people, I feel like, on a whole, have been sort of trained to be a bit more polite.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Which then I feel like kind of impedes social interaction, because you can't really say what you want. And then I wonder how that sort of... Because like, there's sometimes there are friendships where I'm like, you cool with, like, is there anything that troubles you in this? Because you sort of, I just, if someone doesn't say no, I presume they're fine with
it. Yeah.
Like, not in a sexual context.
No.
But, like, in a social context, if someone isn't explicitly saying something, to me, I don't register the opposite.
Because
why would I? But then they're like, you know, that thing, oh, it's a bit uncomfortable. And I'm like, well, why don't you open your mouth and say it then?
I know I definitely have trouble in female friendships explaining how I feel, because I think often women can be, well, certainly my female friends are very afraid of confrontation.
Right.
I know I am, but I definitely have in the past said things when I've been upset, but I think it's had to get to a fairly extreme point, or they've done something, they've kind of done something very definitively wrong, rather than, oh, just, you know, in general, suddenly, the way you talk makes me feel a bit this way or something. I think that was, I first started kind of doing that when I was like 17, 18. I had a first proper experience with a friend where they did something that really shocked me and upset me, and I kind of thought, oh, I don't really want to be friends with this person anymore.
Okay.
So that kind of caused me to have a conversation where I was really honest about what they did and how that made me feel. It was the first time I'd ever kind of done that. And I remember that felt really liberating. And I was pretty proud of myself for that, but I remember a lot of my friends kind of, I think, being a bit afraid of me.
Okay.
And thinking, oh gosh, like, what's wrong with her? Why is she doing that? You know?
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, that I think once I'd done that, it kind of raise that as a possibility for me with future friendships. I think I then had a bit of a tendency to kind of finish things like quite regularly. It happened a few times. I don't think that's just I was attracting the wrong people in friendships, but it happened a few times then where I was kind of able to say, look, I'm not happy with what you've done, and I kind of draw a line under things. Whereas perhaps, you know, if I'd stuck it out in silence, I might have been able to work things out. But I also know that's really not a healthy tendency. But I think also maybe having that, me with my extended family being Irish, I do also see kind of Britishness and British behaviour as something other to me and my experience. And I know some of my friends at university, you know, absolutely loved them, but I did also get really frustrated sometimes thinking, God, you are so English. I know that you're upset with me or something, but you are just not saying it. It comes across like hostility sometimes when people can't, you know, express what they're thinking, because it does kind of just push you away, and sometimes people just give you these kind of blank looks and you think, what's the problem? Stop blinking at me. Say something.
That sounds very creepy. Just an English person blinking real quick.
Exactly. And I think, well, who do I think I am? Like, I've lived in London my entire life.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's interesting how it sounds really cliche and even a bit divisive, but I do think people's nationality and where they've grown up has a massive impact on the way they kind of behave towards other people.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know if it is divisive. I mean, I think there's a difference between fearing difference and acknowledging difference. And I think, like, people who are Italian very definitely have a very different way of interacting on a large scale. Obviously, there are probably also thousands or tens of thousands of Italians who behave exactly like a German person would or an English person. But then if I think about my Italian friends, they're all very open and bubbly and like kiss when they meet you or say goodbye, or they hug you quicker. I think there is a very different way of approaching things, just because culture is usually, I don't know how it evolves, and that's sort of the fascinating thing, but I think there is a bigger culture you live in, and I think there's sort of things you strive for almost in a culture. And I think, I don't know if, like, I agree, I'm someone who ends things very, very quickly when there's something I just think is fundamentally different in our ideas of life. And I wonder sometimes if that is a problem or if that is a right.
I do too, so much.
And I mean, it depends on, I think, how it makes you feel. I think if it makes you feel uncomfortable in a way that might lead you to growth, it's probably stupid to give that up. But I think if it is uncomfortable in a way that you're just not compatible, and that compromise just doesn't seem... Because, like, clearly you've evaluated the person against the compromise. Mm. And if the compromise doesn't seem like the more... Is that right? Is that what I mean? The person against... Yeah, the compromise that you'd have to go. Mm. And if the person isn't more important than... Isn't sort of important worth. Enough for the compromise, then why do it?
I agree. I really agree. But my mother always brings this up with me. And I think that she thinks that I'm this kind of angry, intolerant person. And it makes me really upset that she thinks that about me. And I wonder, do I have that impulse because, you know, I saw my parents break up. Mm. So I'm kind of reenacting that that action over and over with my own relationships that I've... You know, because I saw that happen at quite a young age, I've just applied that way of thinking.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And ultimately, I've never regretted the friendships that I've let go. And I know it was for the right reason myself, even though it kind of appears to other people to be kind of, you know, a bit bitter or unforgiving. But I also think that there's a really strong impetus on women to kind of let a lot of things pass, and I think also there's this massive kind of importance placed on women having a best friend that they're totally inseparable from. And as much as I have really, really close friendships and a few people that I would call my best friend, I also think that's quite unhealthy to place that on young girls, young women, I think that kind of comes out of a place of not thinking that women are kind of good enough by themselves, that they kind of need this other person to kind of support them and go around with, when shouldn't we kind of celebrate girls thinking, no, actually, I need to think about what's best for myself sometimes.
Do you feel like that's something that, because I would imagine that friendships are equally displayed for men and women. Like, I think boys also have their best friends, don't they? Do you feel like it's different?
But when I think about kind of, even just thinking of some visual representations of children or whatever, I kind of see boys with their gang of friends, and then I'd see girls with their one best friend that they do everything together with, you know?
That is an interesting thought. I mean, I don't know if I've ever had... I think you sort of go through phases, because my best friend when I was a kid was a boy. And then you sort of have a clique of friends. Like, I don't think I've ever had that one best friend. But I find it very interesting what you say about replicating that sort of severance of your parents.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely something that comes up in my therapy, that it's like, you know, sort of just because you're used to that feeling of detachment, that you just sort of recreate that. But then on the other hand, it might just be that you are aware of what isn't good for you. And so you let that go.
Yeah.
And maybe... And as you said, you've never felt bad about it, so it seems like you have a very good handle on why you're doing it, you know, just randomly going, you've said something that annoys me, then bye. Which is definitely something I've done. Like, like I've definitely deleted people on Facebook, but it was usually ignorant or homophobic shit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so if, you know, you like UKIP, I'm just going to delete you. Which again, in retrospect, it probably would have been a healthier conversation and would have gotten like somewhere completely different if we had just a conversation about it. Like, you can't change people's minds if you just retract.
Yeah, but then again, it's also not your responsibility to do that. Kind of, you know, these social media spaces, they are social spaces. They're meant to be things that kind of ultimately make you feel comfortable and happy, and if something's annoying you, then you have every right to get rid of that. But also, I do kind of feel like with political differences, I do feel sometimes that you're never going to persuade people.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
very true.
I think the way that you think politically and towards, you know, kind of issues like LGBT issues or race issues or whatever, is indicative of a kind of set of priorities and kind of criteria that you've been brought up with. And as much as you might argue the most brilliant and convincing points to someone, if they've grown up with this totally different set of priorities, I sometimes think they're never going to get persuaded to the other side, because you just prioritize totally different things, you
know? I think it depends on why they are on that side. I think if it's a lack of education, you can educate.
Yeah.
But if it is a principle, you can't. Because if someone's seen all sides and made a choice.
Yeah.
And I think in that case, of that specific friend, it was a lack of education rather than a choice against people. Like, he was a hardworking dad who still couldn't feed his family. Someone coming in and going, that's the people who are at fault.
Yeah.
It probably is quite, you know, seductive to just believe in that, because of what else should you believe in, that the country you live in doesn't value you? Like, you know, it's, I don't know. But it's very true. I think you have the right to create your own bubble, because why would you want to fight continuously in your day-to-day life when the world is sort of adverse enough? But going back to dating apps.
Yeah.
So we have Tinder and Bumble and so Hinge. Have you had different experiences, more positive experiences through Hinge?
Yeah, I feel like I've had a lot more normal conversations, to be honest. I am possibly going on a date from it on Monday. We'll see how that goes. Again, you know, it's so weird dating when you're not really looking for a relationship, though, because that actually happened with me recently, where I went on 4 dates with this boy that I kind of had known for, I'd known at university, and really, really enjoyed them, really liked getting to know them, but you just eventually reach a wall where you kind of realise, but I'm not actually looking for a relationship, and it's a bit irresponsible to keep doing this when, you know, they don't understand, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
So yeah, dating when, you know, you're not looking for relationships, kind of how far can you go until it becomes a bit unfair on the person? So that's kind of bothering me a little bit as I'm using these apps.
It's also very interesting because you say you are someone who is a monogamist and sort of usually looking for that. What do you think prompted you to go, actually, I'd like to go away from that and experiment a bit more and use those dating apps in a different capacity?
I think just genuinely seeing myself as having to deal with another person's problems. Mm-hmm. And I think when I'm in a relationship, I really do kind of throw myself totally into it, and I'm all about being 100% there and 100% supportive.
Yeah.
And the idea of having to do that for someone just made me feel exhausted, literally. And I think seeing how, honestly, the reason why the relationship came to an end was because I just had this yearning to meet new people.
Yeah.
And obviously a relationship doesn't prevent you from doing that, but kind of getting to meet people and being able to flirt with people and whatever, that was starting to really excite me in a way that it hadn't at all before. Yeah. It was like my dreams kind of told me to do it, sounds crazy. But I kept having dreams about just kissing other people, literally, which sounds horrifically tame. But I think the fact that that's what my subconscious was yearning for in my dreams, is to simply just kiss other people. Yeah. Says a lot about, I was just really needing kind of an escape and trying new things. So I think that's where that came from. And it's like, I genuinely feel horrified at the idea of being in another relationship right now.
But you feel very attracted to the idea of casual.
Yeah, and just genuinely meeting new people.
Yeah.
And I think dating apps are kind of a good shortcut for that. I mean, you know, you could go out and meet 3 new people in a week that you've been chatting to. What other way do you get to do that, actually?
Yeah, that's very true. It's very efficient.
It is very efficient.
Which is, I think, why it scares me so much. Because I'm like, because that theoretical possibility of maybe meeting someone down the pub, it's fair enough, and then I can still avoid eye contact. It's very hard to do that on a dating app.
Yeah.
Because like, I was on Bumble, even business, and I just sort of let the conversation slide and sort of let that end. Because it's like, oh, actually, I'm not interested in more social interaction than I already have. Mm. Which I guess is why I am no longer on any of those platforms. Because the Tinder thing was just too much. It's just too confusing. And I think it's that quick connection that gets me off of those. And it's interesting, like, for you to, it's in the entirely the opposite thing.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely awkward. There's something completely bizarre about the fact that if you then meet up with that person, it's so weird how you're both completely on the same page.
Yeah.
Like you're both there. It can't really go that wrong because you're both there for a reason.
You both
know what that reason is. You both know that you're attracted to each other.
Yeah.
And that's so strange, because I think it's frustrating, but it's totally natural that if you meet someone, you're kind of, there's a bit of guesswork involved. Yeah. And is it normal to have all that kind of just confirmed for you and put out there, you know, served up on a plate? I don't know. It's weird. But then maybe it is kind of healthy, because it shows people that you can't just presume that any random stranger is attracted to you. Maybe it's kind of,
it even teaches that there has to be a certain kind of reciprocal,
an agreement energy. Somehow. Yeah. Is that a positive thing, I guess? You know, it's...
Yeah, I think that there can be, like, because I think people are very quick to draw negatives from dating apps, and I think there can be positives. Like you said, it's so easy to strike up a conversation with a stranger, which you don't usually do.
Yeah.
Especially in a world where people tend to like being on their own. And social interaction is sort of very minimal. You actually get to talk to people. And then obviously it depends on, I guess it's not just platonic because you're on a dating app for a reason. But if those conversations are healthy and fun and they don't have to lead to anything and everyone knows that, then it might just be a very good way of getting out of the shell of not being particularly social. And And yeah, I think there is a quality to the fact that you have to match and you can't just... And like, obviously there can be negative things, like people can still ruin that, or you meet each other and then actually there's no chemistry.
Yeah.
And I think there is a sort of a concept of both people have to want that interaction to start, which I think it might be quite a teachable moment for people, that you can't just talk at people and think that their reaction is going to change. Because you've told them to smile 50 times now. And I think, yeah, I think eventually at the end of the day, it's about people finding their way of being able to connect to people.
Sorry, my stomach's making so much noise.
It's fine. Stomach was making the exact same amount. We haven't had breakfast yet. That's what you just have to be aware. There's a lot of stomach rumbling. But I think we can go off and have food soon. But is there anything that you have sort of, because you said you've been thinking about it a lot, anything, like any bigger conclusions that you've drawn for yourself out of this experience so far?
Yeah. I don't know. I think what's weird is that I think the constant question that comes up is this, you know, symbolic of us as a generation? But that in itself is a really interesting question, because I kind of feel like as a generation, we're really preoccupied with defining ourselves as a generation.
Yeah, like, that's so true.
What, you know, what's going on? Why can't we see ourselves as part of just a general trend of humanity and something that's always happened? Yeah, I don't know. Technology interfering with our relationships. It's bizarre, but, you know, I don't think we should be so quick to cast it all in the same light. And yeah, I feel like I am constantly learning a lot, and I'm learning a lot about myself. I'm not just thinking, oh gosh, everyone's so weird online. It's definitely teaching me a lot about myself. And yeah, I'm just kind of looking nervously into the future and seeing how it's going to turn out. I don't know, but you know, I'm open to it. I'm kind of equally excited and nervous as I am about everything. So.
That's really exciting, though. I feel like if we leave this conversation here today, I feel like we need to revisit that in a few months' time and see what...
See how it's gone.
Yeah,
review.
How it's gone.
Yeah, definitely.
Get a check into your adventures.
Yeah.
But thank you very much for coming here. I feel like we've had a really huge chat that went from relationships to therapy to the NHS.
Really diverse. Love it.
It was really fun.
Yeah, definitely.
And I mean, I think people, in the end of the day, take away, just do what you feel like doing, and I don't know, maybe do try and keep eye contact and see what happens.
Yeah.
I think that's my personal challenge to myself. Let's try to keep eye contact that we feel really uncomfortable with, unless it's like creepy ass eye contact. Don't stare at people. If you meet a stranger or if you meet a colleague in the hallway and they're making an effort, try and make that effort back.
Push through the awkwardness.
Yeah. See where that leads you. Maybe you'll have your real life Tinder experience there, then in the office. Maybe you don't. But thank you very much.
Thank
for
you.
Today. Let's revisit this in the future. And everyone else, stay happy. Try and make eye contact on the tube. Or don't. It's up to you. Have a good week. Hear you again next Thursday. Like and review on iTunes. It genuinely helps the podcast. It's so annoying and tedious, and I know, but do it for me. Tell a friend. If you like the podcast, tell a friend. And if you want to be on the podcast, tell me via email to masturbatorspodcast@gmail.com. Au revoir.
Bye.